So now we will turn to a panel discussion where we will ask individually, we will ask several questions to our keynote speakers. And I think Patrick will also join us on the conference call here. Before I start to the discussion panel, I would like to introduce one participant of the panel who we haven't heard of from the keynote sessions. That is Mr. Safiq Ali here in the stage. So he's the director of two Islamic websites in Indonesia, that is NU Online and also islami.co, if anybody ever heard or accessed the website. For a number of years, he's also been tackling online religious extremism in Indonesia specifically. And he's also a member of Gus Durian Networks and has continuously worked tirelessly to create bridge between religious communities in Indonesia. So please welcome Mr. Safiq Ali.
So, okay. Over here?
Sorry?
In this chair?
Yeah, just like casual discussion here. Okay. So for first question, so I have the privilege to ask several questions to our keynote speakers in this session. So when we see there are a lot of damages being caused by like online extremism in various countries, for example, in Indonesia, in Germany, and also in Myanmar. So I want to know if there is any legal umbrella being applied in respective countries, for example, in Indonesia, to counter that movement. And if there is one or if there is any, what is the institutions responsible for tackling that? And do you think it is good enough, it is effective enough to do that?
We have many legal umbrella, I think, in Indonesia. We have an anti-terrorism law and we have also ITA law, information and electronic transaction. And also we still have KUHP. And I think it's quite enough to tackling online extremism and also extremism. Personally, I think maybe this is quite elastic. For example, the ITA law. This is not only enough to tackling online extremism, but I think this is maybe we give the government or the state more power, I think, to limited access of freedom of expression. So this is the problem, I think, in Indonesia, because maybe, we face an extremism in one side, but we have also respecting the freedom of expression. And in our law, I think we cannot deal with that.
Okay, so the very law that also helps curbing the online extremism also, at the same time, hampered people from doing like online expression, right?
There are many cases that there are many people that are sent to jail because of maybe we call it blasphemy or something like that. That this is not related to extremism.
Okay, so the very idea of extremism then can also be like shaped by the government itself, because it is such a rubber band law where government can put like the specification of what is extremism and such.
Yeah, maybe because maybe we don't define what extremism is. For me personally, maybe BNPT, the national body of anti-terrorism, define extremism is everything that related to violence. But in ITA, the people can report it to the police because of something that actually not related to violence. Because of maybe they're speaking about sentiment, maybe religious sentiment, but the sentiment, they're speaking about maybe hatred. Some of hatred motivated by religious sentiment and justified by religious argument, but I think is, for me personally, is it's not proper for them to send to jail because of that.
Okay. Bapak Nasir, maybe you have something to add on this matter?
Yeah, actually we optimist with the law in Indonesia. And Recently, we knew that some people got arrested before they do something. So it means that it's a good thing our authority make an action before they do any action.
Okay, so it's like preemptive movement they do like this offline hatred, violence, they can already detect the movement from online, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But sometimes it is also questionable when sometimes people just use the sentiments of like being sad that there are Syrian uprising and stuff, and it is labelized as like violence when they just like normal people who just want to express themselves. So that is the double-edged swords, I think, of the existing regulation in Indonesia. But maybe Saijai could also elaborate on, in Myanmar, is there any regulations to curb this online hate speech and extremism?
So yes, there is a law. The law that I mentioned was called 66D, telecommunication law in Myanmar. But instead of that law was used to combat hate speech, the government used that law to silence journalists and activists who say something against the government. So I think, yes, there's a law, but there's a problem of how we enforce this law and how that law was used.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Maybe, Patrick, if you can hear me, do I see on that side?
I do. I can't see you, but I can kind of hear you.
Okay. So my question is, can you hear me? If there is any law or existing regulations in Germany that is being done by the government to curb this online extremism and online hate speech, is there any in Germany such things?
You mean like law?
Yes, regulation or law.
Yes, of course. Last year, 2018, the government introduced the Netzwerkdurchsetzungsgesetz, that's a very German word. So the law basically did some good things. First of all, the major social media companies have to have a spokesperson in the country who's responsible for hate speech, for hate speech on their platform. And also, they are responsible to delete hate speech within 48 hours. It was widely discussed, this law, because, first of all, the problem is that we take very, like, thing, deciding what is hate speech, what is hate, to the companies. They do, in a way, law now. That's the first problem. The second is, they hired companies to do this deleting. So there are people sitting somewhere in a call center, outsourced a company. They are not hired by Facebook, of course, with the rough working conditions, deleting 8 hours a day and watching these harmful content. I think it's a question of how does a democracy handle these kind of topics, and should we pass our capacity as a state, as a society, to say what is right and what is not right, what is hate speech, what is not hate speech, to a company? And secondly, is the company really doing it the way we want them to do it? Also regarding the working conditions for the people who have to do this really rough job.
Okay, thank you. So we see that in various countries, for example, in the case studies we discussed before, in Indonesia, in Myanmar and Germany, there has been like existing laws what government try to curb this hate speech or online extremism. But then we as civil society may also question if the very definition of extremism is being defined by the government, and they have this authority to define what is extreme in that case or what's not, then it is for us to also serve as a watchdog, as Saijie explained in her presentations before, to know if the law is being applied to certain extremism that really is extremism or not, or it's just to curb like any narrative that is against the government and being labeled as hate speech, for example. So we were talking about the government, but there are also another actors that is very important in this online extremism distribution of narratives, that is the tech giants. For example, the social media platforms like Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram. Like in Patrick's presentation, we see that the far-right movements, they utilize YouTube, Instagram, and also Facebook and Twitter to further spread their agenda. And also in the case of Facebook, the hate speech being vitalized in Facebook to further make people do online hatred, like violence. But I wonder, in your opinion here from Panasir, Pasafik, Saijai, and also Patrick, is it really possible to moralize these tech giants to make them comply to what we think is important? Because we see that these tech giants, these social media platforms, are also companies that is, you know, they work for profits, they need people engagement and such. But then when there's problem like what's happening in Myanmar, in Germany, and Indonesia, is it really possible to like quote unquote moralize these companies and these tech giants? Maybe your take?
Yeah, if the question is possible, of course it's possible. For example, maybe if you look at the Twitter, maybe it takes 4 years, long years, for Twitter and YouTube and Google and Facebook to take action against extremism. Because maybe 5 years ago, they're still in the position that they're embracing that net neutrality. Mm-hmm. But in 2014, for example, Twitter removed more than 400,000 accounts that suspiciously affiliated to ISIS. And also YouTube, they remove 100 or maybe 1,000 videos in YouTube. And also Facebook, right now Facebook developing artificial intelligence to remove automatically the content that suspiciously related to extremism. For example, if maybe you post Khilafah flag in Facebook, maybe it will disappear automatically, maybe after 2 hours or 3 hours, for example, like that. So if the question is possible, it's possible. But for the internet, this is not possible. But for the social media company, it's possible.
So it is possible to make these social media companies to comply with what we need as a civil society.
Yeah, if the question possible, it's possible. But
do they want to do it?
Yeah, they've done it, actually.
Okay.
But the problem is, this is about the moral foundation about that. For example, Facebook. They have a problem. For example, the hate speech. Yeah? What is the hate speech for us, for Indonesian people, for Myanmar people, for American people, and for Facebook? Maybe this is a difference. So that's a problem. There is a relativity on moral. So we have to define, maybe we have to agree on maybe the universal definition of this, this term, for example, the hate speech. Because in Indonesia, and right now, because maybe in the world, yeah, we are living under the culture of hatred. And almost very easily to find a hatred in social media. And many people see that this is not hatred. This is part of free of speech.
Okay.
So that's a problem.
So there is a problem between like the thin line between the freedom of speech and also a hate speech. When in the hate speech is actually not freedom of speech for most of us. But then people, when their content is being blocked and when they're being their account being removed, they're like oh, the government tries to block my freedom of speech, like something like that.
Yeah. What, take example in America. You can express hatred to other people in America. But in Indonesia, you cannot express it actually. Based on ITA, yes, you do not allow to do that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the tech company, what the basis that they want to use to take action in the posting in their platform, for example, YouTube or Facebook or Instagram or Twitter?
Yeah. Well, it's such a complicated way, like, do they want to do it or not? Do they? Is it profitable for them to do it, or is it the moral judgment? Whose moral judgment is it to use when we define what is hate speech, what is extremism and such?
Actually, the tech company have done many things on this issue, I think. Maybe Mark Zuckerberg have said that he apologized for what's happening in Myanmar, and so they set up an artificial intelligence. But it's not enough. I met with a Facebook officer maybe several times, and actually they still have no idea how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Actually, we have no idea how to deal with online extremism. For me personally, I have no idea how to deal with online extremism, how to combating this, but I know what I have to do right now. For example, to combating this with peace and positive content. This is about education, but education is also not enough. We need a law. We have anti-terrorism law, we have ITO law, the problematic ITE law, but also, yeah, but we need more than that, I think. Also, the tech platform, they need maybe they need a moral foundation to do some things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are so many sides of this aspect, right? Okay, so that's from Indonesia. Maybe Panas, or we can move to Sajai.
Yeah, company cannot control every single account because it's millions of accounts. So that's why the company need us to help them. Report, yeah, report the account, okay? So then the company will block the account. So it means that we all should do something. We all, yeah, should give report. The second is, yeah, we have the law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the law is to control. So that's why in Indonesia, recently, yeah, some words, yeah, some statement, and then because of the law of ITE, yeah, that Mr. Savik said, yeah, people can make have a lesson learned about that. Mm-hmm. It's hard for us, yeah. People are free to talk to say anything, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The education is need, yeah. So we tell our children and our people that please use your words wisely. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people, yeah, because of many reason, and then they use bad words, yeah. So the ITE law, yeah, it needs, and then people who against the ITE law, they are got arrested. Mm-hmm. So it can be lesson learned for the others, yeah. So please, yeah, control your words,
control
before
words.
You get arrested.
Okay.
So it needs
before you get arrested. Ooh, such a strong word. So before it's like your mouth is your attacker. Now it's like your words. What you posted online can come back to you. So we note that several aspects from Indonesia case. We see there's need for education, for digital literacy movement, and also for people to also actively reporting. So sometimes in the case also with hoaxes that spreads on your family groups, on your WhatsApp groups, it is not because the hoaxes itself is very convincing. It's not just because they're convincing. Maybe us, we see that it is a very stupid thing, no one will believe it. But because it is Because us, we think it is stupid and no one will believe it, and we don't try to counter that hoax and stop it from that, then it spreads and people trust it. So it's a lesson learned from us, and what Pak Nasir told us, watch your words before you get arrested. Okay. Next we have Saijai. Yeah. Maybe you can also explain more about...
So, to your question whether is it possible to regulate this tech giant, to answer that question, I think right now we live in the world that it's clear that the action that they did has been a threat to democracy. And it's been a threat to... It can lead to real world violence. It contributes to genocide and ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's not a question about is it possible or not. We have to, you know, like we have to regulate this. And if you think about social big giant tech company, their goal is to make money, right? So they need to be in a society that, apart from making money, they have to think about social consequence of their impact. So to answer that question, I think at the end, it came to law and regulation and government. I felt like we live in the world that all the tech companies keep innovating on this new technology. Mm-hmm. Government and the UN body need to keep up with that. You know, we need to keep up with this. We cannot let the situation happen. And okay, since there's no law, it's okay for this to happen. So as a government and a UN body, I think that we need to come with law and regulation, and this should be a priority in order to tackle this issue.
Yeah. So aside of these tech giants, the government also needs to catch up to regulate the tech giants. So it's not a question whether is it possible or not, but they have to.
Yeah.
Okay. So Patrick, do you have a take on this issue? No.
Okay, I'm really thankful for the last statement, because it's really important to say it's not a question should we regulate them, we just have to. And I also think that it's not any solution to say okay, it's our responsibility as citizens, because these companies do earn like for example Facebook $55 billion a year with us. It's our data, it's our attention they are grabbing. So it's their fucking responsibility. But of course it's not as simple as this, because it's you're still hearing me? Yeah, maybe. I just continue. Because the regulating, yes, but I think the most important thing is not only regulating hate speech, but regulating the work these platforms work. Their business model is to grab our attention and to sell it. Hate speech is only one part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And the other part of the problem is that all our attention goes to these networks. They disrupted the way our public works, they do something with the way we as human beings work, the cycle works. So fixing the recommendation algorithm, because I think that's the core about regulating these companies. It's not only regulating that there's less hate speech, but it's about regulating how the recommendation algorithm works. And that's unbelievable complex, and it's even itself the question how the recommendation algorithm works. There's a big controversy about it. Just one small example, you might remember there was a shooting on the YouTube headquarters in California 1 year ago in April 2018. A YouTube creator went to YouTube and shot herself, hurting three other people, because she was believing that Facebook's algorithm tries to prevent her videos to get viral. So it's just a small story that illustrates how complicated the discussion is, because, and you mentioned it on the discussion already, because the discussion about the recommendation itself is highly controversial, because people think it's moderation, is against free speech, but it isn't, I think.
Okay, thanks, Patrick. Okay, so when we talk about the tech giants and how they regulate or moderating things that occurred on their platform, it is also very controversial. For example, like in the case of Indonesia, some social media platforms have done things on curbing this hate speech, but also us, the citizen, who also has to actively involved, for example, in reporting and such. The next question I have is actually very towards Panasir on terrorist networks. So I wonder, since now they use social media as the channel for recruitment and also to spread their narratives online, has the demographics on these terror networks also shift or change? For example, I wonder if like children can also involved because they now can access the internet, like more young people are being part of the terror networks and also maybe women in the terror networks. For example, we've seen some attempted suicide bombing by families, by women, even in Indonesia. And we, in the older days, maybe women cannot really involved like if they have offline meetings. But now that there are the media on the online sphere, now they can also involved. I wonder if there is a significant change on the demographics of these terror networks, whether like children, younger people, or also women are also become more involved in this terrorism network.
Yeah, it's not change.
Oh, okay.
But this is the habit. The habit of the group is copy-paste.
Copy-paste.
Yeah.
It's copy like my paste. Student in the university.
Oh, yeah.
Copy-paste.
Copy-paste. What is the Middle East do? They want to do.
Mm.
Okay. So, terrorism Indonesia, yeah, since NII movement, mm-hmm. it's already happened. Yeah. But they not call as terrorists. Yeah. But later on, why? Yeah, churches bombing on 2000 because they observe that the other country also destroying the holy place of the other's religious, and then they do that.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's prohibited in Islam, but they just do. Second is car bombing. It was never been happened in Indonesia.
Yes.
Okay, even in the conflict Ambon on 98. Never been car bomb,
mm-hmm.
but on 2001, yeah, there's a car bomb, the first car bomb in Indonesia in Jakarta, yeah, it was been set up in front of the Philippines ambassador residence. Why? Because they copy what the Middle East people, I mean the jihadists, Middle East jihadists, do. The car bomb. Okay, next is. Suicide bombing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kill yourself is haram.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It was not been teach by Islam, but the struggle in Indonesia in the name of Islam is also been a long time, but they never kill themselves. But why? Yeah. In Bali bomb, they set up two men, one in the Spanish pub, and the others in the car. In front of the Sari Club. These two boys have been suicide bombers, the first suicide bombers in Indonesia. Why? Because they copy from the jihadists in Middle East, and then they said, especially in Afghanistan or in Palestine, they observed that these people suicide themselves in the name of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So they do the things. Now we observe that there's a woman, children, it's also copy-paste there. Yeah. Look, in the time of ISIS era in Syria, there's a videos.
Yes.
Yeah. The videos, children carrying arms and killing the men, the tight enemies. Okay. So they think that if in Syria the children can carry arms and killing the others, so why not here? Yeah, in the others places, the others country, the jihadist woman also carry arms and killing others. So why not they? Why they not do that? So this is what the copy paste culture happened in Indonesia.
Okay, so I wonder it was because of the internet, because like they can access.
Of course, because the IT is helpful for that. Mm.
Yeah. So first, it is a copy paste, because in the Middle East they do this, then we can do it too.
Yes.
And then also it's being amplified by the internet, because it is, and then the family bomber may be also being motivated by that.
Yeah, but we not blame the internet. Mm. Yeah, we blame the person. Yeah, who misused the internet.
Yeah, it's not the internet per se, because we all use the internet for good intention, but it is who use that internet, who use exploit this very medium, these very tools to do extremist thing, for example. And I think this could also be a question for Patrick. Can you hear me now? Yeah. Okay, so is there any shift maybe in far-right movements in Germany? I'm not very familiar with these far-right movements in Germany, but since they use the Instagram and YouTube, and also we see the hip-hop music with such a very engaging content, do you see, is there any like significant shift of demographies of the movement itself?
Of course, there is. I think there is a shift in the demography. First of all, there is copy and paste terrorism in Germany too. I really do like this analysis. We have the same, because I, like I said in my talk, we had this terror attack in Halle, East German city of Halle. It was a copy and paste of the New Zealand attack. It changes the demography dramatically, because like I grew up in East Germany, and East Germany was the WAF area in the 90s. With a lot of neo-Nazis there. And their tool of recruitment was to give, for example, CDs with like a neo-Nazi rock music to the schools. It was a good tool for them, but now the far right can just point to everybody on the social net. They don't have to go to the to schools and hand in CDs. They just go on Instagram, and this changes the demography in two ways, I think. First one is people get younger. People like youngsters getting politicized or interested in politics with like 13, 14 years old, and they just all this information online where they're spending their life. It's just their normal life. It's not online, it's just their world, which is mixed online, offline. And the alt-right is just over there. Secondly, the alt-right, not only because of the internet, but also because the appearance of new far-right movements like the identitarian movement is more or less successful in getting more educated people, more like urban culture people. Even the neo-Nazis in the 90s, using more or less the same tools or the same ideology of meetup politics, didn't succeed in getting to this urban and more intellectual student kind of people. But now they do, to a small extent still, but they have access to this more more intellectual urban people, and that is dangerous.
Okay, thanks, Patrick. So we see that the demographies also change in the Germany case, but for like the Indonesia case, maybe it's not because they spread the narrative online per se, but also because the group itself copy paste the the idea from the Middle East. So to sum our discussions, I would like to ask the final questions to each of our speakers here. What do you think is the best counter mechanism that we can do as civil society, maybe, or as people, as regular people, to curb this spread of online hate speech and online extremism? In your opinion, maybe Saijai would like to start first.
Yeah, so I think one technique that we're trying to use is that we know how hate speech was spread spread, right? Like if you look at the Trump campaign or Brexit campaign, yes. They target people who like undecided, mm-hmm. and then you bombard them with a message that might change their mind. So I was thinking, why don't we do the same with digital literacy? You know, there might be some people in the world or in Myanmar that they might not decided yet what is, for example, with the Rohingya crisis or with different issues. So why don't we target it, use the same tool that they use for hate speech, but targeted these people and target them with peaceful message for ask them to change their mind. So I think that's one solution. But overall, I think digital literacy is the key. It should be the skill for the future. And I think like the government should integrate that in the education system since the young age.
Okay, so digital literacy and tapping to the population that is being targeted by hate speech to tap them to spread peaceful message. And I think that's what Pak Nasir and also Pak Safiq has done into a very great extent on what they did and what they are doing right now. Okay, since the time is up, I'm sorry that maybe I cannot give Patrick the... Oh, it's okay to ask for Patrick? Okay. So Patrick, the last question? I think it's delayed. So what do you think is the best counter mechanism for us as a society, as a civil society, to curb the spread of online hate speech and online extremism?
Media literacy and bringing media literacy with these media platforms to the people is a brilliant idea. Since I'm a journalist, I really think that like journalism plays a major role because the core idea of journalism is make strangers look less strange, like to connect people. And so journalists do have to change their minds too, because it's not only like, it's not one-way communication anymore. I think journalism is supposed to get into this discussion online and serving the community in the sense of enlightenment, big words. But I think that's really the task of journalism, to get back to the discussions of people, and these discussions do find their place online, so we have to be there. Second is regulate guidance and even break Facebook. I think in the US this is a discussion, and we really need to discuss it maybe this way. Maybe Facebook is just too big to handle, and Facebook does not know what they do. And third aspect is, we talked a lot about like our discussion into like counter narratives. I think that's important, but also it's about emotions. If there's something we can learn about from the alt-right, it's that narratives alone won't help. It's also about hearts and minds. It's not only about minds, but also like hearts and souls. So we don't only have to be the smarter because we are smarter, but also like we have to be the cool gang on the schoolyard.
Cool,
I think.
Okay, cool. Okay, thanks, Patrick, for your take. Maybe.
I think there are three approaches that we can do to deal with extremism. The first, I think, is the law enforcement, mm-hmm. and the two, education. But this is very difficult because there is no single narrative on extremism. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of issues. For example, jihad, togut, Islam under attack, or yes. kafir, or this bela Islam, for example, like that. There are a lot of issues on this. So this is there is no single narrative. So we have to define our narrative. We have to tackle on every narrative. So we have to create a counter and alternative narrative. Mm-hmm. But also we have to organize people to educate the environment, the community, so they engage in this action, in this education. The third is, I think, is also quite important to create, in some level, the social pressure. Because I think this is not only the battle of ideas, but also this is like a psychological war. Yes. If this extremist group, they get their confidence, so they can be much more dangerous. So we need to pressure them on online or in offline, because this is a very, very important. For example, in the university, for example, maybe based on our research, there are 23 students, 3% student, Indonesian student, that willing to do jihad?
23%.
This is quite big in Indonesia. So this is very important to create some action, organizing people to give them some social pressure on their community. So because this is not only a battle of ideas.
It's also an emotion. So I think what we note down from Patrick's, from Saijai, and also from Panasia and Pacific ideas on how this extremism can spread online, it's not about the idea itself, but also the emotions involved, like anger, feeling of being suppressed and stuff. It fuels people's emotions and make them willing to engage to that narrative. So that is also what's very important for us to take note. What I think I remember from the narrative of war, it's the US actually on Iraqi war, it's like to win people's hearts and minds. So it's not just on the physical war that they win the people's hearts and mind and was very important, but now since the information, since the media also now become a media, a medium for the warfare itself, the information warfare itself, we need to win the people's hearts and minds to further spread peace campaign, positive campaign, rather than these extremism narratives. Okay, since I think the time is up, Nadine already hold the sign for a couple of times. Thank you for such a fruitful and engaging presentations and speaks. Thank you, Patrick. Maybe you'll hear me later.